Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, and with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of ImaginePublicity.com, welcoming you this Saturday evening, each and every Saturday, to provide you with enlightenment, education, and entertainment about crime-related issues and the aftermath of crime. And this evening is no different. I just want to welcome you, all of you, this evening, and thank you for joining us across the nation. And I have to say, it's nice to be back in the home saddle here after a whirlwind tour of Washington, D.C. and National Crime Victims' Rights Month. But that's another topic for another time. But I want to tell you that I'm back, and it was a very rewarding time. So why don't I bring in Delilah. Good evening, Ms. Delilah, and how are you on this nice day?
Oh, doing great, Donna. It's a beautiful spring day here as well, and I'm enjoying it, and I hope you are too. I know you had a big week in Washington and met a lot of wonderful people. I've heard great reports, and so congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And we are, as soon as I tackle the technology, we will try to get some of that information up to maybe within the next week or so, because it really was. And I thank all of the people that were so hospitable to me. And I just have to give a shout out to Aunt Seymour, because she rocks. She is a wonderful, wonderful person. And I happen to know that our guest, prosecuting attorney David Laban, is a friend and fan of hers. So, you know, and he's no stranger to that area as well. So that is who we have as our guest, and he's a repeat guest, and I'm so pleased to have him, as I know you are. And last time we talked about his organization. You know, he broke off from the pack, as it were, and is the president and CEO of the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, which has a little bit of a different focus, and I think it's really designed to help focus in on the needs of crime victims, and I so applaud that. But we're going to go back in history a little bit with him and talk about the days of when he was in California, and one of his specialties was in prosecuting gangs. And, you know, we are familiar with that due to our friend and colleague, Yuli Garza. She may or may not have an appearance with us this evening, but if she's not, we will be sure to give you an update on her case, and perhaps they can get together at another time. So, David, without further ado, thank you so much for being on Shattered Lives a second time. It's such a delight to have you.
Thank you, Donna and Delilah. It's great to be back.
Whoa. We're so glad to have you, especially on this topic, as I think it doesn't get enough airtime. And there's certainly a lot to be learned, and I think there's a lot of stereotypes out there, going way back to the early 50s of the play with West Side Story, and then the movie in 1961. It is a whole different world out there. It's not like the Jets and the Sharks, and we have to tell people what is the reality goes on with gang culture, and maybe from the prosecutorial perspective, we will understand it, putting our information together with what we have learned from Yuli. So if you would be so kind as to maybe give us a bit of an overview on how gangs historically have been prosecuted and the components that go into that.
Sure. And I was going to start a little bit saying that I spent 10 years in Southern California. I was with the Orange County DA's office and, in fact, was a member of the original gang prosecution or the gang unit back in the late 80s. And a point there, mm-hmm, with folks like the sheriff saying, we don't have gangs in Orange County. This is, you know, Orange County is nice and clean. It's safe. We might have some neighborhood organizations that sometimes cause members in the community problems, but there's no gangs. And then following it after that, spending 10 years in Sacramento on behalf of the California Dealers Association, working very much in the policy and what can we do? Because when you talk about gang violence, certainly you can say, how can prosecutors be more effective in courts? How can prosecutors, this law enforcement, try to solve the crime? How can prosecutors and law enforcement work with the witnesses, try to get folks to come forward? But the thing with gang violence is community and address is a community issue. There's really nothing the police and the prosecutors can do. And that's why the keys with gangs is the intervention, the prevention, and ultimately, if necessary, the suppression. Then after my work in Sacramento, now I've been in D.C. for the last 8, and definitely on behalf of the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, we're looking at how can prosecutors create safer communities. So back to your issue of gangs. Gangs are nothing new. They have been, in, especially in this century, since at least the turn of the previous century, go back into the late 1800s, and look at folks like the Irish. They were created through gangs. And really, any time in the history of the United States, you could look at the Chinese population, you can look even for a time there, even the Catholics, feeling as though they're oppressed, is any situation where you've got a majority population and a minority population, and that minority population believes the majority population is pulling the levers on power. And so if the minority population can bond together, that they can, you know, basically run their own laws and maybe even against the majority population, wreak havoc and cause them some pain. But traditionally, that's been the basis of gangs. That's even been the basis of your type of the Italian population with the mafia. It's doing things in an alternative way, doing things for profit, whether it be gambling or drug running, or actually in the 20s, you looked at the movement of alcohol, and then the continued use of violence. Somebody steps out, first you can look at the mafia, and then you can go to California street gang. If you step out of the gang or quit the gang, there's the jumping in ceremony and there's the jumping out. And the jumping out will be a tremendous amount of violence and further the reputation of the gang. And so whether it be gangs from 100 years ago or gangs today, they're very concerned that those around them, whether it be rival gangs or members in that community, know how violent they are and how willing they are to immediately resort to violence in order to further the gang. And again, look at the old, look at the new. What's going on in our gangs today? Our gangs today, it's about drugs. It's about gambling. One of my other projects is the animal cruelty. It's animal fighting, dog and cock fighting, but especially dog fighting, to send that signal, we're violent. If you cross us, we'll hurt you, we'll kill you. But in the same way, the profit motive. Can you make some cash? Can you run some drugs? And the ready a source of weapons. Should a rival appear, or should someone who is perceived to be a rival appear, that there is no questioning, it goes right to violence, immediate death.
Is it possible to actually get out, or how likely is it that someone can actually get out of a gang without being killed? Is it very rare? Is it, you know?
Certainly, one can get out of a gang without being killed, and that's why there's two ceremonies in the gang. One is the jumping in, but that's the joining, and here we're talking about street gangs, and most particularly, you'd be talking about street gangs as it relates to especially Southern California. There are jumping in ceremonies, or there are things they must do in order to join and show that they're, quote, down for the gang, and in the same way, at the time that they choose to get out of that gang, it's the jumping out ceremony. And that jumping out ceremony will involve violence, but does not always involve death. The leaving gang for a rival gang is now a situation, and that's predominantly, or let's even step back. In Southern California, you have three types of gangs, but they are separate and distinct in many ways in the ways that they operate. And that would be your Asian street gangs, your Hispanic street gangs, and your Black street gangs. The Asian street gangs, the jumping out and jumping to another gang, because Asian is not necessarily territorial. It's most always about number one, and number one being money. Jumping to another gang and being unfaithful or disloyal to your previous gang, that can lead to death. That's not as common in Hispanic and Black gangs, because they continue to be territorial gangs. They are identified many, many times by particular streets or parks or regions or neighborhoods, hence their name, 18th Street. So that's what identifies them. There, it's the unusual phenomenon. You've got generational street gangs. You've got dads, sons, grandparents, grandfathers, basically there. It's the male lineage, not the female. We can go on about female gangs as well. But what is unusual there is that now you have generation after generation of families being involved in the same street gang and really in no manner assimilating into a broader, whether it be their own racial group or an interracial group. They continue to be their faction and their gang.
So the Asians don't really mark out a territory. They operate on a different plane, so to speak. Is that what you're saying, as opposed to the other groups?
Correct. The Asian gangs, and in many ways the Asian gangs are also different, is they will be multiracial. And but for the fact that they're a street gang, you could look and say it's a bit of a United Nations. So it is not uncommon with an Asian gang to have Black members or Hispanic members. But very much on your question, which is something that we heard quite a lot, especially from the Hispanic street gangs, is they would use the phrase, the Asian gang is invisible. And by that, what they mean is they got hit by a rival gang, a rival Asian gang, and so immediately the Hispanics did what's quoted arming up, and they went to go to do the payback. So they armed up for the payback. They went in their world thinking neighborhood, location, you know, they're going to find them, find the rivals, and they were not there. And so that's why they use the phrase, and quite often there they will get caught. They'll get caught with the weapons, because if there's good police surveillance, they realize once you have a victim gang, that victim gang is likely to strike back. So they're the ones that get caught with the weapons. They didn't have the opportunity to use their guns, and their complaint was, quote, they're invisible. So that made it difficult for them to do the paybacks, because they're not in a location. And they're not protecting the territory. That is a significant difference with the Asian gangs.
So they operate singly, maybe at the behest of the leader or something?
No, they do not operate singly. They do not have particular marked territory would be the significant difference. They're not necessarily geographic.
It's harder for law enforcement to find them.
Oh, absolutely. But there, again, if you have good intelligence, you can figure out where they're assembling. But with the Asians, many times it's referred to as a crash pad, that they've got a location, probably a house or an apartment, where a number of the members are at. That's where they'll have their drugs, many times stolen property, guns. So the crash pads are important. Also, a lot of times cafes or billiards rooms. But it will be mobile. Just because the one particular cafe was their location last week does not mean it's their location this week.
Hmm. Wow. Very, very sophisticated.
Well, David, you made the point about, you know, of course, the Asian gangs, it's all about the money. But I'm assuming that money is the motivation for a lot of these other gangs, even though they're territorial. And maybe you can speak to the different activities that the gangs are into in order to make the money, and what are they doing with it? I mean, obviously they're keeping it. They're not paying taxes. But maybe you can talk about the money trail here is what I'm trying to say, throughout the different types of gangs, whether it be the Asians or the, you know, the MS-13, the Russians, and, I mean, all of them.
Yep.
Where's the money trail?
And Delilah, that's a fabulous question, because the answer is many, you know, with Asians, it's really easy, because it is, if you can crack whatever the money stream is, you can really get into the internals of the gang. but you are absolutely right, whether it be Hispanic or Black gangs. And even as you were chatting, you know, what do they do? That's where drugs is the most common thing. It is the most common as far as the marketplace. And so if they can market and push drugs, now they can get cash. They can use their arms to allow for the flow of the narcotic or the substance of choice. And in the same way, they can do their reign of terror upon the community to keep their marketplace safe. Two very appropriate examples. One was, I was recently in Detroit, and speaking to one of their chief prosecutors, and his comment was, how many people are dying because of marijuana? Surprise me, I'm a California prosecutor, and there's a lot of discussion right now on the legalization of marijuana. And
right.
I kind of had the follow-up with that, like, what? They're overdosing, they're, you know, like getting hit by the metro because they're under the influence. You know, how is it they're dying? And the answer is because marijuana now is so plentiful and so cheap that it is all about the access to the open air, many times open air, especially in Detroit, open market, or a particular location where they know they can get a lot of cash. And so the folks are dying because if you don't have a marketplace for your dope, you can't sell it. And if you can't sell it, you can't make money. And if you can't make money, you can't further your gang activities. So because now the substance is so cheap and plentiful, there are more people dying because now they need access to those customers. And if they can't get access to the customers, they can't make their cash. The same is becoming true, unfortunately, with heroin. And that is going on right now in Baltimore. Baltimore's had a terrible rash. They almost lost or were averaging out one homicide a day at the beginning of this year. They had 17 to 20 within the first couple of weeks of January. March has been good, but that was the first month it dipped down. But there have been way too many. And any homicide is a bad thing within a community, but a tremendous number of, and they're gang-on-gang homicides. But now what is true about marijuana at Detroit is true about Baltimore with heroin. It's so cheap, it's so plentiful, that the gangs are killing each other to try to defend their markets.
Do the small businesses in a particular territory, do they just, are all the businesses in this particular area on the take to the gangs, and that's how they establish their marketplace, so to speak?
Not necessarily. There is some connections that you can do between many times it's liquor stores, sometimes little, you know, small markets where they might be moving things in or out. But when they're thinking of protection of their market, they're not thinking like you or I are thinking about, you know, they actually have a storefront. It's instead, mm-hmm. it's protection of a particular area within that community where they know that people will come to purchase. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's many times on behalf of law enforcement, when you see cars in the wrong neighborhood, why are these folks driving in? Why would someone who is lily white driving a luxury vehicle be down the wrong street in Baltimore? They're
mm-hmm.
either A, lost, or B, they're out trying to traffic and purchase drugs, which leads to the other thing is, how do people die? People die by having those that are savvy and purchasing, they might be a known customer. They may be safe in that particular neighborhood because there are a good amount of cash for the gang. But the wrong person turns down that street may cause the gang to go on alert that who is this person? It's either a cop or it's someone that's an informant, and so that individual may lose their life merely because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Wow. It's incredible. It's survival of the fittest. You know, it really sounds like a jungle there. It really, really does. It's very scary. With regard to how you approach prosecutions. Can you address some of that? What was it like in those days when you were part of the unit that you were involved with versus how the tact that they might take today, and is it very different?
It's very different, but in many ways it's the same. Is in order to address, and that's why I talked about the real concept of looking to your intervention, your suppression, and as well as your prevention efforts. In order mm-hmm. to be successful, you need to be a part of the community, and you need to understand a little bit as to why things are occurring within that community. And really, it should be communities plural, depending on what variety of gang you're trying to address, and then what's the strategy to do that. I was privileged to be part of the Target Gang Program. The Target Gang Program is still very active in Orange County, California. It is one of the model programs. In fact, many other violence prevention programs have been modeled that you look, and the concept of the target is, who are the leaders? Who is leading that gang, and whether they commit misdemeanor to murder, go out and aggressively investigate and prosecute whatever case is righteous against them in the criminal justice system. Because as long as folks like them are in the community, you are going to have violence. And if you can take out the leadership, then it's just like any other business. It's going to take a while. They will disorganize. They'll get new leadership again. But if you continually go after that leadership, you have the opportunity to reduce the level of violence in the community. Most of my work was in Little Saigon, which was in the city of Westminster, but also played over into particular areas of Garden Grove and Santa Ana. We reduced the violence in that community by approximately 50%, if you want to talk about violent crimes.
By going after the leaders?
By going after that leadership. And also sending a signal to the gang members that this is not the place to perpetrate violence.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the place to extort people. This is not the place to try to sell counterfeit goods, identity thefts, phones, all the various ways, drugs, that you can make cash, that you're going to get caught, and when you get caught, you're going to be prosecuted. So
long-term
yeah.
sentences, what are we talking about
yes.
in terms of that these days?
Again, the sentences, and that is something you talked about, is that California is one of the states that has a particular enhancement for the gangs. It's the
mm-hmm.
Street Terrorism
right.
Enforcement Program. And that allows for either a separate felony crime for being a gang member or being associated with a gang and committing that crime for the purposes of expanding or pursuing or the benefits to that gang, or B, that the individual gets an enhanced punishment to the crime itself, again, because of the relationship to the gang and how that crime that's committed furthers the purposes of the gang. So, you know, being from a state like California, yes, you can. You can push for long and longer sentences. You can push for things like gang registration when they get out. We used very successfully things like gang injunctions. When you know there's a particular, as we've talked about the drug markets, you know they're dealing drugs in that particular location, and you can prove it, you can do a civil injunction and get them out of that park, get them off of that corner. And in doing so, A, you move the trafficking out of the public. B, you make it safer for anybody who might be going through that area. They won't be caught in a crossfire. And C, that particular gang member that was sitting in the corner is no longer a target for somebody that would want to go ahead and make them the victim of crime. So that's always that thought about. And not only do I talk about the triangle with your prevention, intervention, suppression strategy, but for your active gang member, he and sometimes she is also on a triangle, is are they going to be a victim? Are they going to be a defendant, or are they going to be a witness? Because if they're active, there's crime happening, and they're on one of those three sides of the triangle, or many times multiple sides of the triangle. And that's when you talk about a strategy of getting cooperation and trying to solve the crimes and trying to be able to go to court and prove up gang crime. So that becomes a very difficult strategy, and many times it takes a lot of a tremendous amount of patience and work to present a case.
Well, if you are successful in capturing the kingpin, so to speak, and they go to prison, and then there's a bunch of gangs in prison, so what happens then? I mean, are they automatically indoctrinated into one of those because that's their history and that's how they survive or that's what they know? I mean, you're going from the street corner gang to the prison gang.
Yeah.
Is that how it works?
And many times that's true, and many times it causes difficulty for the corrections officers once they get inside. That now, you know, we've got somebody. Again, the most graphic would be Baltimore. You had one of their gang leaders who was basically running the Baltimore City Jail. I think that was well documented. The surprising thing for me was he impregnated two or three, maybe even four, different female corrections officers while he was inside, that he was so charismatic that these women were apparently falling in love with him.
God,
that creates a problem, and that's why, again, focusing on who it is, and especially as you described their in custody, we had a good relationship with both the Department of Corrections and Youth Authority in letting them know that, and that's also the BD something of the Target program, where I knew who the guy was. I knew him backward and forward. And I knew who the associates were. And so to let the folks know, starting with when they're in local custody at the sheriff's office, look, if you've got a problem or he's contacting people and looking at the jail logs, many times they don't mean anything to the corrections officer, but they mean a lot to the local law enforcement, whether it's the gang investigator or the gang prosecutor. In the same way, now that they're off to prison, who are they talking to? And that's why things like cell phones in prison, those are a really big deal, where a lot of folks on the outside are like, what's the big deal? Somebody gets to call his family. No, this individual's not calling his family. He's not calling mom to wish her happy Mother's Day. There may be dialogue in that conversation that sounds similar to that, but likely as a result of that call, somebody's getting hurt, somebody's going to die. They're, exactly. And so where, and the phrase with inside is kite. You know, sending that message to even some of the corrections officers, they may not understand what it is, but given back to the locals, many times those local investigators and prosecutors, we can unravel it very quickly, and that's what we call inside-out prosecutions, is many times those inside comments are affecting the outside mm-hmm. those prison walls, and by having that information, you can do that. Los Angeles County, succeeded in prosecuting some of the folks that even while they're on the outside, they're having trouble getting cooperation. But by mm-hmm. having the recordings and the jail and prison information, and especially getting wiretaps on the prison
calls.
Yes,
I was just going to ask, is it legal to do wiretaps from from inside the prison to use for prosecutions outside or whatever?
You have two things going on. One is, generally as it relates to California law, when they're in jail, there is no right to privacy to the communications that they are having through, like you see on TV, through the glass. Those will be up on the wall, then anything you're saying, now this is not when they're talking to their lawyer in the separate room, this is just a visitor,
mm-hmm.
is those can be recorded and those can be used. Especially if everyone is made aware, look, there's no privacy to your conversation. But when you want to go ahead and get into the phone records and get not only who the individual is calling, but the content of that call, that requires a warrant. But yes, based upon the level of violence, and it would be case specific because we need to go to a judge and seek that wiretap, but it is possible to get a wiretap.
Uh-huh. Wow. So it sounds like correction officers then need to have a greater level of awareness or education in terms of what the communication actually means or the significance of it for use by outside prosecutors. Am I right in that? Why is there not this awareness? You'd think they'd be very savvy to everything under the sun that goes on there.
that's where, and there are many very excellent corrections officers, and, you know, many times they'll have suspicions about what it means, but because they're not from a particular community, because the other thing about corrections at the state level is many times the individual will be transported to a remote location. Again, California Department of Corrections, they'll end up in the high desert or something. And so whoever is there may not have a feel for what is going on in the city of Los Angeles or something. So it's correct to say they couldn't tell there's something behind this, but they won't be able to specifically articulate why it's important or how it might work in a particular criminal case. The other thing with the corrections officer is it's very important to immediately keep the pressure off of them. They must work within that institution. That is their life behind bars. And they, too, just like individuals can be subject to intimidation, they can as well. So it works so much better to just, if they find something, have them pass it off to others. So, therefore, they themselves are not investigating the same people they're trying to guard.
Wow. Is there hope to make a dent in the gang population inside prison, or do they just, are they equally dangerous? And I'm just wondering, if you tackle the ones on the outside, then does that mean that there's less traffic on the inside, or does it vice versa, or does one have anything to do with the other? But they're both always going to exist, and you just have to deal with it the best you can.
I hate to be a defeatist, and that's why I'm glad you kind of threw that to me at the end, saying that it's always going to exist, and that's where we started the conversation about, you know, gangs are nothing new.
Right.
Big thing with gangs is what does that individual want? As long as their mission and focus in life is to terrorize people, that they have no community ties, they have no family that they care about, they have no young ones that they care about, and they're just into themselves and they're ready to do as much pain as they can to further their own individual goals, then is whether they're inside or outside, there's nothing you can do. But at the point that they decide that they are tired, at the point that they, many times they have now a baby. You know, someone has they got somebody pregnant, and now, you know, may finding religion. You know, there are many pathways that folks, and you can look at the different folks that are out there speaking, the ex-offenders, where they finally decide, you know what, this is not that great of a life. And I would like to do something else if I would like to change. And what's important in that situation, especially in the correctional setting, is if somebody wants to get out, is that they're getting out of the gang and getting out of the lifestyle, that there's an opportunity that they can do that they can get transferred somewhere, and that they can try to make a clean break. So if they're willing and you've got some programming to be able to help them, yeah, there are many, and you can point to the different successes that are out there. And really look at the amount of work that the faith community does, especially the faith community with the minority community, trying to say, look, it's time to change your life. You're sitting in prison right now. Is this what you want to do for the rest of your life? There's definitely some successes and pathways. And that's the other piece with gang work. You've got to do as much as you can to prevent it. And, you know, the prosecution and the investigation, if you don't narrow that stream, it's going to be overwhelmed. And so getting involved in schools, getting, afternoon activities, getting, folks something, kids, and I was listening to Yuli's thing, program and what she's trying to do, and on her first son, you got to give the kids something to do. You got to give them some hope, and hopefully, if they are more interested than the gangs, then you can start to dwindle that gang population. One of the best programs that we discussed but never implemented back in Orange was that if we could get junior or middle school girls to decide that gang members are not worthy of their attention, that they will not date them, they will not speak to them, and not think that they're cool, that would be a very significant turning point. But as long as the girls are out there thinking how cool the gang members are, and back to your earlier, the Jets and the Sharks, that too contributes.
Wow.
You know, it's socially acceptable. It's something that folks look up to. You know, wow, look at that. You know, he's really a tough kid. He's a gangster. That contributes to it. And whether
where
or not,
did that come from? How did you know, junior high and middle school girls get so much power? I mean, I know they're mean, but
no.
You know,
no,
mean girls.
If they didn't give them the attention that suddenly now,
well,
you know, maybe studying, maybe gaming would be better than banging.
Oh, my goodness. And the whole thing about female gangs, I don't know too much about that. What can you tell us about that aspect?
Same thing.
A whole different mindset?
Right. And the same sort of, like, beginning in the sense that there used to be girl gangs supporting the guy gangs. And so, you know, I hate to relate it to fraternities and sororities, but in the same, you know, little brothers, big sisters, that were big brothers, little sisters, that sort of activity. But this is very equal opportunity, and why should the women have to sit back and let the guys be involved in violence? And so it is scary when you start looking at the numbers. First, I think mostly it was caring. You know, you hear, did this, you know, for the boyfriend. But now, a fair number of shootings and stabbings that they are initiating and doing on their own. And while overall male prison population numbers have started to drop, especially when you look at the women prison numbers, those are rising a little bit, especially in the minority communities, and many of that is because of the rise of now the female gangs, that, you know, they have the same opportunities as the men do, or the boys.
Does it stem, part of it stem from jealousy about, you know, oh, he's my man and you tried to take my man and all that baloney?
Not necessarily. That can also be there, but same with the guys. It can be a girlfriend issue. But more of actually being willing, and traditionally they had not been the ones that were pulling the trigger or stabbing individuals. There now mm-hmm. is a greater willingness to go ahead and perpetrate violence.
And just, yeah, we can do just like the men do. We're just as good as they are, so we can perpetrate violence.
That's right.
Well, it used to be, that joining a gang wasn't part of it a badge of honor because they didn't have family that cared about them, because they didn't have ties to the community, because they didn't have other things to do. And, you know, this is what I'm going to do because this is my family. They love me and they support me and they take care of me. And so I'm going to rise in the hierarchy and this is what I'm proudest of. I mean, is that still the element there?
I don't know that I fully buy into the because I had a bad life, that's why I joined the gang. And I know Yuli talked about like the high unemployment rate and such. But I think when you diagnose
Imperial Valley, yes.
Oh yeah.
So it's not always about the money. It's a lot of it's about prestige and being cool.
You have that, and that's what I will say when you look at a lot of the inner cities. And the reason why many times law enforcement has very good ability to unravel or good intelligence is a number of families are so you've got the same mother, whether or not it's the same biological father or not, but within that, they're cops and criminals. You know, two brothers are you know, one's a corrections officer, one's highway patrol, and the third's in prison, you know, and is a gang member. So it's not unusual for that to exist. That's why I said it goes back to the individual and the individual's willingness and what are they doing with their life. Yes, gangs are the equivalent of family. Yes, somebody might have felt that they didn't get enough attention. Now being a part of the gang, now hurting people, perpetrating violence, gets them attention. Oh, look, now I'm the cool kid. That is certainly a piece of it. But it can't always go that it's the economic condition, because if that were so, then you'd have 100% gang membership, and you don't. Even in the worst communities, you know, the percentage is, you know, not even half. You're looking, you know, at small teens, 20%, you know, L.A., you know, yeah, they've got 100,000 documented gang members, but they have 3 million people, you know. So if what you said is true, you'd have 100% gang membership in particular regions.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're not exactly going to say, oh, join the Boy Scouts as an alternative, but because I just don't think that would work. But there are two elements that I see in the community, in society, that tend to wield a lot of power. And the two, in my mind, when I was thinking about this on the airplane yesterday, and by the way, just as a little funny, I wrote my questions on the U.S. Air cocktail napkins, David. And that's what I have here. But anyway, I'm trying to read my writing. Sports and music. And can't we use those as a positive alternative? And I know that, you know, with the music culture, they get their message out about, you know, anti-gang or they glorify gangs. But those two things, sports and music, is how can we use those to say, you know, these are better than going into the gang for those other reasons?
Right. And I think those two, and with both of them, yeah, there's the good and the bad of it. I'll say with sports, it's almost entirely good, because number one, if you are interested in sports and you're doing things athletically, then I'm a strong mm-hmm. proponent of it. I've done a lot of coaching, especially young folks. Mm-hmm. That gives them that, you talk about belonging, it occupies their time, but most particularly the use of drugs and being out all night and all of the typical gang behavior hurts mm-hmm. your athletic performance. And so your athlete is like, no, I got to go to bed. You know, good luck, guys. But I've got practice in the morning. So they start caring, and that's it. That's back to the individual. What does that individual care about? What's motivating that individual? Why do they get up in the morning? Why do they do what it is they do? So that's really fabulous. I'll say the same about musical, joining between the music or the art, you know, that they have something they care about, and it's a positive influence, and it gives them hope and direction as to why they're doing what it is they're doing. Unfortunately, yeah, I do. You listen to some of the songs out there, and you know, there is a real glorification too. And for someone who's young and impressionable, they listen to the lyrics of the song, and hey, well, that rapper is really cool, and, you know, I can't wait to go, you know, pop a cap, which means I can't wait to go shoot somebody. I mean, that's not good. Some of the internet-related violence.
Another unfortunate thing is that so many of the school districts, when they have funding cuts, it's the arts and the music programs and things like that are first to go, which, you know, are so important just for the reasons that you just explained. There again, it's working on the preventative side of kids growing up in this type of environment to have something like the arts and like music to turn to express themselves rather than, you know, just hanging out in the streets.
Totally agree. And that's where I agree. And the same thing, I've been on a school site council, and that is one of those real frustrations, is don't do that. Why are you cutting the things that probably, for many of them, make school fun, and that's the reason why they'll actually attend school. You make it now just all hard academics. Do they even care about that? And if they don't care, they drop out. And that's also your average gang member. It's about seventh grade, and many mm-hmm. times they're not willing to admit whether or not they can even read or write, or even what their writing ability is. I mean, I had a lot of witnesses that I asked in advance, you know, can you spell, can you write, can you read a map? Because we'd be asking about a location, you've got a blow up there and you want them to go and board in front of the jury. and, you know, put where they were and where the car was coming from. And if they can't read, they can't read the map, they don't know what the street name is, or maybe they have no concept of what a map is at all. And so where you were probably smiling right now going, what do you mean? That is a very real question. Or presenting them the is this your statement?
They may have learning disabilities. They may be dyslexic. Yep. I mean, all of those things can play into it.
Sure.
Yeah, you're so right about that. I know that before we came on air, you were telling us some interesting facts with regard to the gang's colors and perhaps the misuse of, like a handkerchief in the pocket, and that is the opposing gang's color, and that puts you in harm's way and dangerous. Can you talk a little bit about those types of things that those of us that may not be as familiar, we should know some of these things in terms of what signals another gang to say, hey, you're rivaling me, or this, you're adversarial because you chose to wear that type of clothing.
Absolutely, and that becomes that discussion or the comment about, look, my kid was a good kid. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Behind that, David, when they really weren't, because they maybe inadvertently wore the wrong color shirt?
That's that's where I was going to go with it. And that also comes up at community meetings, and it comes up at school meetings. The complaint is usually against law enforcement. Look, my kid got my son's a good kid, but he got harassed because he was wearing blue, or he was wearing red, or he had a handkerchief, or and it's called flying the rag. He had a handkerchief in his pocket. Now, where the parent may think, oh, that's fine, it's just my kid being a kid, and the kid may think, oh, it's really cool. The reason why law enforcement, and all law enforcement did is just question, who is this kid? What are you? Just asked a couple questions. Didn't shoot, did not stab. When a rival gang goes hunting, what is the very first thing they look for? They look for somebody, and that's what the typical red rag, blue rag, quote, flying the colors. They look for what is the wearer, the attire, the baggy clothing. They're not looking. Can identify that person by name, and with gangs, there's no name badge or some way that a rival gang member can be absolutely certain that this person is a member of a gang. Instead, what they're going to do is go look at the clothing, look at the their mannerisms, and they'll make a decision, and that is a life and death decision on the victim of whether or not they believe that person is part of a gang. As it goes back to the enhancement for the street terrorism, we don't have to prove that the person that was killed was a gang member, that they killed a rival gang member. Instead, we need to prove that the killing was to promote the gang. And quite often, that's what occurs, is an innocent killed because they, quote, thought it was cool to wear the colors or hang out. So one is the colors and the attire. And mm-hmm. Not necessarily.
What else do they look for when they go hunting besides
the
attire?
Attire is location. Back for gangs that have territory. If it's a black gang and it's 14th and L, if there's a black person on 14th and L that's young and about the right age for the gang, and they're kind of just hanging out on that corner to a rival mm-hmm. gang who's hunting, that's a gang member. That's a rival, and they will shoot and kill them. And that's that sort of issue about, well, he was just hanging out, he was just hanging out with his buddies. Yes, he may have been doing very innocent things, but unfortunately the location that he went to was very significant for the gang that his buddies were involved or associated with, and most particularly that location became the location where the rivals went to look, and the phrase is hunting. They went to look, and the other phrase is payback. They went to do injury or kill a rival, and that individual was in that location. Therefore, that individual was identified at the time of that killing to being a rival. And that is really the hardest, especially on parents, that they can be absolutely certain that their child did not do anything wrong, but literally by being the right race in the right location, they were identified to be a rival gang member.
Wow. Now, how is it a potential victim, how often are they aware of that? Are they totally naive to this type of behavior that goes on? I mean, I just can't believe that if you live in that geographic area, that environment, that they wouldn't be, even if they're not a gang member, if they're an intelligent young person, they would know that these things go on.
And that's, I join in everything you just said. In fact, I've been working, I know the Yuli, she does a lot with POMC, and I've been working with the father here in the Virginia area where his son was brutally killed. It was part of a drug house, a marijuana trafficking, back to marijuana and the number of people that are being killed on the trafficking of it. But his son lost his life, as did two others, in a raid by a rival trafficking operation. And for everything that I can piece together and talking to investigators and working with the father and trying to, because of the problem is there, because it's gang-related, we have a very good idea of who the suspects are, but the question is whether we can turn anybody and be able to, finally make the case on it. But as it relates to his son, I have to answer your question being the answer yes. He knew who these two brothers were, and he had to have had an idea that they were moving a bunch of dope in and out of that house. He had to know that. He probably had the comfort of, I'm not, like, so if there was a police raid, because that's what most people think about, well, am I going to get in trouble? I know my friend's a criminal, but I'm not a criminal, and I'm not doing anything, so are the police going to do anything to me? And I can prove up I'm clean, right? That's what a lot of the folks are thinking about, is what are the police going to do? And he's right. If the police had hit that particular marijuana home, drug house, he would not have been, he'd been free to leave. Potentially, he could have been a witness, right? But certainly not a suspect. None of the PAO records, nothing would ever relate to him. Nobody could identify him as a seller. But unfortunately, it wasn't the police that hit that house. It was the rival.
It was the rival gang.
Traffickers. And what did they do? They stabbed him just as dead as the other two. And it was a torturous, killing, because likely what they were trying to do was also find out information on the trafficking trade. So it was a horrible way to die. And with that sort of mentality that you just led me with about, well, I know what's going on there, but I'm not a part of it, so I'll be fine.
I don't know. That's just so naive. Even I know that.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. It breaks my heart that we're losing so many people here. We're losing them to intimate partner violence. We're losing them to gangs. We're losing them to people that go missing for crazy reasons. It's so heartbreaking. It really, really is. I don't know. It's a tragedy. How difficult is it how difficult is it to actually turn a gang member or one of the group in order to, get that evidence so that your prosecution will stick or will be stronger, so to speak?
Because it's a human system, it all depends. And before I answer that too much, we talked about all the doom and gloom, but Yuli, with her mother against gangs, there are a lot of beautiful and great things that are happening that folks are doing in the memory of those that they lost. We talk about the crime victim side. There are some people that they lose a family member and they collapse and they don't go any farther. And I know you're in that group also. The true heroes in this are the folks that they lose somebody and they look around and they say, we can't lose others in the same way. And that's why Yuli and Meg, that is phenomenal. Now,
it is.
Back
she,
about...
she's a master fundraiser too, and she just she, her coalition is really, you know, every when you think of the definition of a coalition, it really, really is. And this was right out of the gate when this happened, so I have to, you know, accolades to her, because she didn't spend any time grieving. She was just all about action, and she continues to be. So I'm hoping the two of you will get together, I think. But it's just and that's unusual to me. I was just so amazed at what she was able to accomplish. Delilah, wasn't it something like 3 or 4 months right after the homicide is when we had that first show? And this is what she accomplished?
Very, very near the time that it happened. I was very surprised she was willing to come on. But she's a go-getter. And, I mean, they are such a tight-knit family. And for them to deal with this in the way that they have, I think, is just exemplary. It's just amazing, and not too many people would do that. They have a very strong, close-knit community. They have so much support, and, you know, this is what people need when they're going through, you know, facing things like this.
Yeah, and so then to get to the other half of your question is, it is possible, and I'll add one more anecdotal thing. I remember when I was interviewed, it was the LA Times who called and was questioning our gang program and questioning whether or not we were having any success, because in the first year, we went from 87 homicides to 84 homicides. And granted, that's a lot of homicides. That's more than one a weekend that somebody's losing their life.
Yeah.
But my answer was, that's 3 less families that lost somebody.
True.
And anytime we have even one less, we're doing something. We are having some success. Could we have more? Of course. But there's 3 less folks that are now grieving. There's 3 less families and friends and relatives and everyone involved with it that now have suffered that loss. So I'll always take a reduction in the number, even how small it might be. But back on and that's why when I talked earlier about trying to solve a case and work a case, it requires that patience, because especially when there's a very strong likelihood that the individuals, the victims know who it is. Whether or not they're willing to cooperate, that becomes that question. And then it really becomes the reason for it. And many times it is the family members. And that's why sometimes it does require the patience. Is you may not break that case. You know, sometimes you can get it in the first 24 hours, 48 hours. That's great. That's your greatest likelihood. But other times it's just going to need to marinate a little bit. And finally someone will come forward. And they usually come forward because, especially the mothers out there, is they're watching the pain and the grief, and they finally, you know, whether they would do it for themselves, they wouldn't. But they, many times, for others, and maybe by then something else bad has happened to them, and they are getting tired, and they're ready to get out of the gang, but they finally are willing to cooperate. And that's why once they do, it's really important for the prosecutor's office, law enforcement, we've got to have resources to be able to get them a place to live, to be able to get them to a location many times that they'd like to go, to get out of whatever community they're in so that they can try to change their life. And that's where the relocation funds are tremendously important, as are the anti-gang programs and the other heroes in the community of folks that have stepped away from the gang lifestyle, to immediately that they can get a mentor and they can get somebody that they can see there's a pathway out of the violence. So there are successes out there.
There are relocation funds out there, at least in for some areas. And I'm sorry to say that our hour is fast approaching the ending time, David. Always very, very fascinating show. I thank you so much for taking time out of your weekend. We will have more tomorrow to finish off this showcase. So thank you so much. I will be in touch with you, and we will get in touch with Yuli as well. Thank you, Delilah. We're going to have to say goodnight this time around for Shattered Life, and stay tuned for another show this next week, okay? Good evening, everyone. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.